Hello and welcome to The Menu on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards, doing my level best to fill the void left by the holidaying Marco Sippi. On today's programme, we sit down with one of the world's best chefs, Daniel Hume, to discuss everything from food security to the current state of the restaurant industry.
Food is central to so many issues that we're facing in the world. Food insecurity, health, global warming, the way we farm. In a way, being a chef is a very powerful thing because we can actually affect change.
Then we head down under to meet the team behind Brash Higgins, a low-intervention winery making a splash in South Australia.
In Europe, you have very strict appellation systems. This is a little bit more freewheeling in South Australia, where we can plant Nero d'Avola, a grape from Sicily, for example.
Plus, can designers help to solve the world's food problems? Alexei Korolev goes to Vienna Design Week to find out. We'll have all that ahead, plus the latest food and drink news, and of course, a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. All that ahead for you right here on this edition of The Menu on Monocle 24. Swiss chef Daniel Hume is one of the biggest names in contemporary fine dining, perhaps best known for 3-Michelin-starred 11 Madison Park, his famed New York restaurant, which made the controversial move to a plant-based menu earlier this year. Away from the Big Apple, Daniel also opened another restaurant in 2019, Davies & Brook in London's Claridge's, which managed just a few months of service before its pandemic-enforced closure. With both sites now back open, we caught up with Hume to discuss the challenges of the last 18 months and the future of the restaurant industry.
At first, when the restaurants closed, it was really heartbreaking because we lost a lot of our teams and we had to let go some of our teams. And that was really heartbreaking. And, you know, when I first started cooking, my parents were very much against the idea. But the thing that they would always say is, oh, but people always need to eat, so you will always have a job. And that actually wasn't true anymore. I mean, the pandemic was against hospitality almost. We couldn't be together. We couldn't sit around the table. And so that was also a shock in a way as well. But then, you know, both at Davies & Brook here in London and at 11 Madison Park, we sort of turned the kitchens into community kitchens where we would start producing meals for people in need. And that really changed my life. And it made me connect with food in an entirely new way. It's nice to hear from a guest in a dining room that they just had one of their best meals. But when you give someone a meal that costs $2 to produce and someone who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from, and that person tells you they just had one of their best meals, that is a whole other meaning, and it's very powerful. So I think as hard as the pandemic was, it was also a gift of rethinking, of taking a step away. Especially, I'm lucky that I'm sort of midway career, so I do have a whole path in front of me. And what a gift to have like a timeout.
You mentioned, you know, maybe some time to reflect, time to think about where your career is going. And it seems that obviously you did make quite a big decision during lockdown, and that was to turn 11 Madison Park into a plant-based restaurant primarily. Are you pleased with how it's going? I mean, a lot of has been made of it, but are you pleased with not only how the dishes are turning out, but this kind of new skill set and knowledge that you've acquired as well?
It's extremely liberating and exciting. It was scary at first because most people didn't believe that there was going to be an audience who will pay that kind of money for a plant-based meal. But for me as a chef, during the pandemic, it became more clear how broken our food system is. I also thought a lot about what luxury means and what is the new luxury. And I realized that a lot of the things, and I feel guilty myself, but a lot of the things that we are still holding on to and celebrating are not luxurious at all. Like some of these ingredients, like caviar, for example. Caviar is farm-raised. It comes from far. It's plentiful. You can buy it almost anywhere. You can actually find caviar at the airport. And it doesn't even taste good compared to what it once was. So it's an old idea that we're holding on to. And I think the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, I just committed to myself that I'm not going to continue the way we have. And the future, in fact, is plant-based. It is crystal clear. It is not sustainable in the way we farm and the way we consume meat. It was also like, I realized that this is the direction the world is going and this is the direction we have to go. So this isn't an anti-meat movement, but this is pro-planet. And as a creative working with food, I feel like the creativity should go towards creating magical dishes with vegetables. The world definitely does not need another preparation of a butter poached lobster or a crispy skinned duck or a foie gras. We just don't need that in a creative way. And, you know, I've been celebrated as a chef, pushing the boundaries and change to stay the same. And so if that's really true, I almost felt the responsibility to open up that dialogue. We wanted to make sure that by doing so, we wouldn't lose any of the magic or any of the deliciousness of what a meal was before. And we definitely studied what makes a duck so delicious, or a lobster, or a crispy pork belly, for example. And we thought about that, and we, for example, at 11 Madison Park, we added one course is a fried course. We have this fried pepper because it's like biting into something fried is incredibly satisfying and delicious. But it also, you know, the fried course doesn't make it sound like that. But overall, the meal, my experience has been that the meal is a lot healthier than it was before. And also the guest experience, there's almost this euphoria at the table where I don't even know where it's coming from. But before it was like, by the time people got a main course, they were so stuffed and overly filled and kind of ready to go home. And now the energy level is very different. As the meal progresses, people, it seems like, are having more and more energy. And, you know, they go home and they sleep much better. And the next day, if I see them or they call me or write a message, everyone is so thankful they had a healthier meal.
I mean, that's really interesting to hear. I've never thought about it in that context before. Moving on to London, obviously over the last year, it's been quite difficult to travel between London and the US. How has it been for you? Has it been difficult not seeing the Davies and Brook team, you know, managing, I guess, from afar?
Absolutely. Of course, we always want to be together in the same room and in the same kitchen. I did manage to come during the pandemic a few times, and it was actually not as difficult as you would think. But, you know, we're also just challenged here with figuring out. We also had a lot of people leave, like people went back to Italy, to France, too. So there was also a shortage of staff, which is a big topic right now. Yeah. And it's real. Even for some of the greatest restaurants in the world, they're actually having a hard time to find staff. I think that's one of the bigger challenges we're facing right now.
And obviously, before the pandemic, you hadn't had too long as a restaurant. It was only a couple of months of service, wasn't it, before the closure? And I mean, I was going to ask, you know, how long does it take a kitchen to get back into its rhythm? But if so many of the staff have had to actually leave the country, where do you begin again? How do you pick up?
I'm really proud of the team that's there. And most of them moved here from New York. Some of them are European, but they worked with us in New York. And in particular, the GM, Annika Brooks, and the chef, Dimitri Maggi, and the sommelier, the wine director, Gabrielle. And it's just an incredible, the core team is super, super strong. And they went through a lot, but they stayed positive and optimistic and have managed to uphold the incredible quality that we stand for.
I mean, the strength can kind of be seen in the fact that the restaurant recently won the service award at the National Restaurant Awards. How would you personally describe that atmosphere and service that you're trying to achieve? And I mean, despite all the setbacks, it's managed to endure throughout.
It made me really, really proud, of course, to receive this award, because I believe as a chef, even as important the food is, and I think the food is probably the thing at first brings people to a restaurant, but it's really the service that makes people want to come back. And it's the way they felt, you know, in the dining room. There's a great quote by Maya Angelou. And she said, you know, you don't remember what they said, but you'll always remember how they made you feel. And I think that is so true for a restaurant, and that is service, you know. And we've always tried to sort of, you know, move the conversation forward. What is a fine dining meal? Like, we believe in fine dining. We believe in the artistry of service, of cooking, of a beautiful room, beautiful table settings. But it has to evolve. In the old days, it was more stuffy, was pretentious. It's not a place any of us ever wanted to go to. So it just had to evolve, and it had to be more friendly and less stuffy. And I'm so proud. I think Annika is doing an incredible job. And I think it's some of the best service you can find anywhere in the world.
Maybe moving on to the industry as a whole, we've touched on a few of the kind of contemporary issues that are facing the industry at the moment, but where do you see it at the moment? Are there any changes or trends you've noticed of late?
Well, the future is plant-based. You know, that's the biggest one. And if you pay attention, it's very clear. Even if you see all the documentaries that are coming out about the sea and about the farming and about the global warming and all these things, I mean, you can't ignore it. The way we have been doing things are not going to work much longer for our health and for our planet. So I think the future is pretty clear.
And how does this tie in with the next generation of chefs? I mean, quite a lot of chefs are French trained. It involves, you know, a lot of dairy, a lot of meat, a lot of fish. How does that kind of change, I guess? Does the training maybe need to change, or will maybe people still have that same training and then apply it to more plant-based things and vegetables?
I thought, for me, I almost had a responsibility to open up this possibility. And I thought about the car industry, actually. And I thought about the Toyota Prius that came out 25 years ago, and it was the first hybrid car, which was absolutely groundbreaking. But you had to be really committed to the planet to drive that car. It's a similar person that is drawn to the vegan restaurant. People who have been ahead of all of us, the majority wasn't. And it really was when Tesla created a luxury electric car. I mean, Volkswagen and so many other brands are turning entirely electric in the next, I don't know, 5 years or so. So I think it's similar to this. This is where we're going. We need to make it more sexy, more delicious, more magical. And I felt we had the opportunity to do this, which this will allow the chefs of the future, the up-and-coming chefs, it will allow them to follow suit. And if we're creating a new luxury, then everyone's thoughts will change.
And you mentioned at the beginning that cooking and working in hospitality, it was always seen as something that, as you said, you know, people always have to eat. And our concept of that has changed a little. People obviously always have to eat, but whether they have to eat out is another matter altogether. I read that you began in cooking as a means to an end whilst you were a cyclist. And a lot of people, I guess, do that. But now we've seen that it's not always going to be a viable career in some ways. Do you think that's impacting this staffing shortage that we're seeing at the moment? Do people still want to become chefs?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question. I think we all just need to have an open mind. I mean, one thing is true, that people always need to eat. They don't always need to go to a restaurant, but people do need to eat. And even more so, I think food is central to so many issues that we're facing in the world. Food insecurity, health, global warming, the way we farm. I mean, it's just connected to all these things. So in a way, being a chef is a very powerful thing because we can actually affect change.
That was Daniel Hum in conversation with Monocle's Charlie Filmer-Court. For many years, Brad Hickey toiled away at New York's best and brightest restaurants, becoming the first American sommelier to work at Café Ballou and wine director of the two Michelin-starred restaurants Boulet and Danube. A decade of late nights, however, took its toll. Burnt out, in 2007, Brad travelled to Australia, where he met his future wife, the winemaker Nicole Thorpe. Together, they launched their own label, Brash Higgins, which has since gone on to make a real splash in the wine industry. Clarissa Sebag Montefiore travelled to their vineyard in South Australia's sunny McLaren Vale to find out more.
A lot of the Australians that I worked with when I was pruning, one of the jobs I did in the vineyard in that first year, none of them were called by their Christian name. Everybody had a nickname, whether it was Whiskers or Bobo or Knackers or Bedsores. And Brash became my nickname, being from New York, and was sort of a welcome to the community.
I first tried Brash Higgins in a restaurant in Adelaide, a 2015 Cabernet aged for 9 months in a French oak hogshead. It tasted of spiced plums with a slight hint of licorice and a sprinkling of earth. I tracked Brad down.
What's exciting to you about South Australia as a place to make wine?
I think it's the freedom to really pursue lots of different vineyards, lots of different grapes. We're not as restricted as they are in the old world in Europe, where you have very strict appellation systems. This is a little bit more freewheeling in South Australia, where we can plant Nero d'Avola, a grape from Sicily, for example. McLaren Vale is coastal. It's much more, it's not as generational or as traditional as the Barossa Valley, which is very much tied into its German roots, whereas it's not uncommon to find six, seven generations of families that have lived and farmed there. So it's much more conservative.
Brash Higgins is all about taking a step away from high technology. The vineyard is organic, grapes are picked by hand, and the winemaking itself is bespoke. Brad has even embraced ancient European techniques, in particular, vast, gorgeous 200-litre clay vessels created by a local potter in Adelaide, which pepper the cellar.
One of the things that we were interested in was using clay vessels like they would have done in Roman times, ancient amphora, which we've had great success with. Zabibo is another white wine grape that we've been exploring. So typically most white wines are pressed off the skins immediately and the skins discarded. In this case, we make it more like a red wine where we let the skin stay with the wine for all throughout winter and into spring here. And that actually gives the wine a little bit more texture, more tannin, more grip, more savoriness, where the wine smells sweet, but it's completely dry on the palate. So you have this Alice in Wonderland experience of something it feels and smells like a sweet muscat, but when you drink it, it's wonderfully fresh and zingy.
Should we go and check out the vineyard?
Yeah, let's go. So just taking a look at some of our last pick of the year, this is Grenache and Mataro.
It's beautiful color, very dark grapes, lots of stalks in there as well.
Yeah, it's a bit of that. So we like to have a bit of the vineyard in there with the grapes. Most of my wines have a little bit of savoriness coupled with that sort of fruitiness that you get from McLaren Vale. It's nice and warm here. I mean, it's essentially the same climate as North Africa. So if we can get a little bit herbal, a little bit of spiciness with the sort of sweet fruits of the district, I think that's really attractive. It's almost to me like drinking a Negroni.
Fantastic.
Everybody likes a Negroni. So we're just taking the cover off of another one of our wines. This is Nero d'Avola. So this is fruit that we grow here at Omen Setter Vineyard, which is the name of the vineyard for Brash Higgins. I'm just going to do a punch down, which is using essentially a sort of stainless steel plunger, which allows me to pierce the cap of the fruit and mix it up a little bit. So I always like to think of it like you're breaking the top of a French press in coffee. So we've got a beautiful cap of fruit. And all I'm doing is just pushing down to get that cap nice and wet and release some of the heat from the fermentation that's happening here. So we've got a very beautiful active fermentation happening. And all we want to do is once or twice a day, just stir it up a little bit, keep it happy, keep it healthy.
And you can feel when you push your hand across the air, across the fruit. You can really feel the heat coming off it, and it's all bubbling as well.
Sounds like being on the ocean, doesn't it? Or maybe a bit of a gentle rain.
It does. It's quite beautiful. It's quite mesmerizing to watch.
The vineyard is a world away from the hustle and bustle of New York. But as Brad says, for him, it is far more satisfying. He works with his hands. He creates rather than serves. And he has the sky over his head. For Monocle, in the McLaren Vale, I'm Clarissa Seabag Montefiore.
Now, let's continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here's Monocle's Carlotta Ribello.
Thanks, Tom. First, let's go to the States, where in Kentucky, Diageo has opened its first carbon-neutral distillery. The spirits producer will use a mix of wind and solar energy to power the distillery's equipment throughout the cooking, distillation, and dry house processes. With the capacity to produce up to 10 million proof gallons per year, this distillery might be the first of more to come. Next, to the UK. Having left the EU, a change in regulations has brought the prospect of genetically modified foods being grown and sold one step closer in England. It will allow more field trials by companies and research organisations to take place to develop GM crops. While the move has been welcomed by industry and some scientists, public opinion on GM crops in the country remains largely sceptical. And finally, Croatia wants to make their dessert-style prosek wine a traditional term under EU law, but they've faced pushback from another winemaking nation. The Italian wine body Federvini said the move was unacceptable as the name is too close to prosecco. While the wines differ in their style and taste, Federvini has described the move as an assault on our culture. It's yet to be seen who'll emerge victorious in this battle of the fine wine. That's all for this week. Back to you, Tom.
Thanks, Carlotta. You're listening to The Menu here on Monocle 24. And finally, on this week's programme, we travel to Vienna, where the 15th edition of the city's Design Week is taking place. Apart from celebrating good design, craftsmanship and art, one of this year's main subjects is food, with designers pondering sustainable solutions to consumption and production in particular. Alexei Korolev, Monocle's correspondent in the Austrian capital, went along to investigate.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Hubert Klumpner, one part of Urban Think Tank Next, right here from the Sachsenplatz, from the Vienna Design Week.
In front of this year's headquarters of Vienna Design Week is a van. But it's not just any old van. It's called
Studio Mobil, a research caravan, if you want so. And we are building our own models, our digital models, but we're also engaging with the population 24 hours, debating, discussing, and designing. It's also a studio, a film studio, etc. And we are on the street and working with this vehicle.
This mobile laboratory has just been to Sarajevo, where Urban Think Tank Next studied ways of revitalizing the city's waterways. But here in Vienna, its research focus is food.
Obviously, it's all about the culture of the city. What else would you expect being in Vienna than sipping your coffee, which we call here a melange, not a cappuccino? There's a whole lexicon of names. We are often unaware in what networks we are actually sitting. Coffee is not coming from Vienna. However, it is part of the urban culture. So we're not looking only at the snails that are produced also in Vienna, or the cucumbers. Vienna is producing cucumbers for the whole country of Austria. But we're also looking at those larger contexts and how the people in the city have built an entire ecosystem around these different food cultures, the spaces where this food is consumed, and how it is made, delivered, and brought to your attention.
Inside the Festival Centrale is another interactive installation centered on food and consumption. It's called The Ideal Eating Experience, and Katrine Dankel is the curator.
You are in the middle of a snack bar. a small supermarket, and you have the choice between 15 products that you might choose. And behind those products are projects that are actually concerned with food on different layers and levels.
There's a shopping list.
Keep the shopping list.
There's a shopping list and a pen.
Yeah, so you get your shopping list and you take a look at today's offers.
Can we go with salmon?
Yeah.
And then tomato salad.
Okay.
And for dessert, let's pick apple strudel. So now you've written it down, so now what happens?
You actually go through the exhibition, make your way and search for your salmon snack.
Oh, there it is.
There it is.
Let's make it clear, it's not actually salmon. There's no food in this exhibition.
Not really.
Yeah.
It's designed.
So we picked that, and this is the project that is associated with it,
and it's from Sweet Sneak, and it's a project that is concerned with microplastic. And you're invited to sort of get familiar with the project, which actually are images that sort of reflect on microplastics in our food. So that's why we chose or associated with salmon.
I go through the same procedure with my other snacks before arriving at the cash desk.
Now you get your bond.
And you get your receipt. And what you get is actually your carbon footprint on the one hand side. And it's connected to a system called Ein guter Tag hat 100 Punkte. A good day has 100 points. And it's for balancing your whole sort of carbon footprint. And you shouldn't actually spend more than 100 points for everything, for living, for mobility. And for food, 25 points would be good.
Yeah.
So as you can see here, you have 16 points, which is fairly good.
So what will you do?
Well, just take this with me, and then I'll think about it.
That's already.
Can I take this?
Yeah, of course. It's all yours.
Cool.
So that's what we
all. Thanks
what
a lot.
We would like to have some reflection.
Yeah.
If all this seems a bit too theoretical, here's another project taking center stage at this year's festival. It's hands-on and fun, and it also invites you to try an alternative, more energy-efficient way to cook.
My name is Lotte. I'm working for EOS Next, a social enterprise based in Vienna, Austria.
Lotte Christofferich explains.
We are featured with a slow cooker, which is a bag where you can place pre-cooked food, and it is being cooked while you do something else. It is an open design manual.
An open design manual, what does that mean? I can make it myself.
You can make it yourself. Yeah. What we do during the design week this year is we offer workshops where visitors can come to the Festivalzentrale and we guide them how to produce their bags for their own personal pots. So there's a manual where you can easily adapt the pattern.
To fit any size.
Exactly, yes. We have the pleasure to collaborate with Gabriel, which is a Scandinavian textile producer. And they gave us lots of cradle-to-cradle certified fabrics for free. And that's the material that we're using for these bags.
And I can see one of these. This is the finished bag in front
of us. This is the finished bag in front of us. It holds a pot of ratatouille, which is going to be served later on. So every day we are serving one pot dish for whoever is around. So I think it's a very nice addition for the Festivalzentrale.
Yeah.
Especially for the people who are spending lots of time here.
Different projects, different approaches, same subject. And one essential point: that the future of consumption needs to be more sustainable, and that the transition to that future should happen sooner rather than later. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thanks, Alexei. That was Monocle's Alexei Korolev reporting from Vienna Design Week. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Don't forget, we'll be back with a brand new episode every Friday at 20:00 London time. That's midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show, Food Neighbourhoods, for easy-to-follow recipes from some of the world's best chefs. My thanks to our producer, Charlie Filmer-Court, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our editor, David Stevens. I'm Tom Edwards, in for Marco Sippi. He should be back from his enforced 2-week detox. in time for next week's programme. Once again, we finish the show with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here's Booker T and the MGs with some sizzling green onions. Thanks for listening.